morning. It is Sunday, September 28th, 2003. This is Sunday Salon, heard every week at this time from the historic studios and frequency of the nation's first community radio station, KPFA, in Berkeley, California. I'm Larry Bensky, here with you these 2 hours, with listener participation, as always, as we look forward with a measure of dread and anticipation to the California recall election in less than 2 weeks. Next week, we're going to be spending both hours in a pre-election special. This week, we begin by talking about another electoral contest, the Democratic race for presidency, with candidate Dennis Kucinich live with us here in the studio. Stay tuned. There are now 10 officially announced candidates for the Democratic nomination for the presidency in 2004. Dennis Kucinich, one of those 10, announced his candidacy back in February, and since then he's been traveling the length and breadth of the land, including many times in California, to make his case to the voters. The voters, however, don't seem to be very tuned in yet to the Democratic contest, if you believe the polls, and we can talk in a minute about those polls. Something like 70% of those polled recently couldn't name a single candidate among the 10 for the Democratic nomination. Dennis Kucinich is a populist, a progressive, a former mayor of Cleveland, a former member of the Cleveland City Council, who conducted a historic battle against the forces of corporate capitalism when he was first elected mayor, trying to stave off a bankruptcy of his city by preserving municipal utilities under public ownership. He was elected to Congress in 1996 after what I think he would agree is a peripatetic political career. And in Congress, he's been one of the staunchest progressive voices. He now co-chairs the 52 or 54 members. How many are in the Progressive Caucus now? 54-member Progressive Caucus in Washington. And he is the first of the Democratic candidates to have accepted our invitation to be on this program. We have invitations out to all the others, and indications are that some of them, certainly probably not all, will respond and be joining us on these airwaves. Welcome to KPFA and to this broadcast, Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you very much. Honored to be on your show.
Dennis Kucinich, as I said, you've been traveling the length and breadth of the land for, about 7 months now. And one of the leading things that we see in electoral politics in this country is the phenomenon of non-participation. The fact that even in this hotly contested recall candidate election with 135 candidates, et cetera, it's going to take place in about 10 days. Estimates are we'll be lucky to have 40% maybe of the potential eligible voters vote. In the gubernatorial race last year, it was about a third. Many people on the progressive, populist, liberal side of the spectrum say, if only we could get the rest of those folks interested and involved in voting, we would have a very different type of electoral spectrum in this country. Do you agree with that, number one? And number two, what have you seen as you go around the country that indicates to you that this kind of energizing of the non-participating people is possible?
Well, first of all, I think we have to acknowledge the reasons why people do not want to participate. I mean, that's a statement in and of itself. And I think one reason would be that politics often does not relate to people's practical aspirations for jobs, for schools, for health care. It should, but it doesn't. And people see the system as being inaccessible and, in some cases, as being irrelevant. So we need a politics of relevancy, a politics that comes from the heart, a politics which connects with people's ideas of their world that can be created through their passion, through their involvement. So I haven't given up on that process, obviously, but it is significant when you have half the people not voting or less than half participating in a major election.
Your congressional district, like every other one, contains about 600,000 people, of whom, 450,000 would be eligible voters. They're old enough and they're citizens and could vote. And last time in your district, only about 190,000 people voted. Again, fewer than half, isn't it? About 42%. What do you see there in your district of the west part of Cleveland and the near suburbs when you go around and talk to people? You don't have very difficult electoral races there anymore. You won with 3/4 of the votes cast last time. What do they tell you, the non-voters?
Again, I think it's about whether people can connect to politics as a part of the big picture of their own lives. And one of the reasons why I've been able to do so well in Cleveland is that I've been consistently involved in issues of saving hospitals, saving a steel mill, saving an aerospace plant, keeping train traffic out of heavily populated residential areas, all those things that relate to quality of life, to economic opportunities. That helps gain the confidence of the people. And I think people will participate when they have not only confidence in the process, but also when they have the economic ability to be able to solve some of their more basic needs. You know, you can see a direct correlation between political participation and socioeconomic level. And as people become more and more poor, they're riveted to the daily problems of existing. And voting sometimes doesn't have the highest priority. But when we make a connection between that existence and voting, that's when the transformation can occur.
You're one of 10 now candidates for the Democratic nomination for presidency. How do you break through to get to people with that kind of message when there's so much other signal-to-noise traffic out there of people trying to make their statements? I noticed, for example, today that the Associated Press has a quick interview with Howard Dean, considered to be one of the leaders among the candidates, in which he talks about how the president and the people around him told lies about Iraq and getting involved in the Iraq War. Now, I follow these things pretty closely, and I know that several weeks ago, you and two other members of Congress got up there and said the same thing. In fact, you said it even more strongly, asking for an inquiry into this lack of veracity on the part of the Bush administration. You got very, very little media coverage. Here's the Associated Press going out all over the country with Howard Dean jumping somewhat late on this particular bandwagon. That has to be kind of frustrating for you.
Well, it's not frustrating because where does it go from there? I mean, we're not just spectators making commentary. If Mr. Dean believes that, then he ought to support my call for an immediate U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. If we believe, as I do, that we're there based on lies, as I've been saying for even prior to the invasion, then the logical thing is to say, well, it's time to get the UN in and the U.S. out. But to simply make commentary about the condition without advocating a course of action is to reduce the quest for office to something that's just narration instead of movement towards a conclusion.
A lot of the publicity that is given to Dean and Kerry and now Wesley Clark comes from their fundraising abilities, what has been called the wealth primary, where candidates are legitimized by the amount of money that they're able to take in. Of course, the president is able to, with a snap of his fingers, take in millions and millions of dollars in weekend events or whatever he wants to have. But the Democratic candidates altogether have raised a fair amount of money, and you seem to be coming in at around $2 million in this reporting period. Is that more or less correct?
I think we're, as our aggregate is going to be over $3
million. Over three.
And we're raising money on a grassroots campaign. I think there needs to be an awareness on the part of voters where candidates get their money from. And this campaign is not just about money. It's about organization. It's about enabling people to connect to policies which result in a better America. You know, when I've talked about getting the UN in and the U.S. out, those are policies that mobilize people. Today, tens of thousands of people will be gathering all around this country, you know, in the Bay Area, as well as in Southern California, in Seattle, in Chicago, everywhere, calling for the U.S. to get out of Iraq. That one issue will be responsible for mobilizing people, and in a way, that will even usurp the power of money, because the power of money is one of the things that took us into Iraq, and it's the power of the people that will take us out and establish new policies and that will elect a new president.
What I'm getting at here is a lot of people that we were talking about in the opening who are alienated about this process say, and I know you hear this, They're all bought and paid for. They raise tons of money. What has any of that got to do with me? It's all about money. The money comes in, the votes go out, and that's how it works. And I noticed, for example, in your last two campaigns, you won last time with 74% of the vote against a Republican who got 24%. Time before that, you got 75% of the vote against a Republican who got 22%. Virtually uncontested elections, one would say. And yet you raised, in each of these elections for your Cleveland district, over $500,000 each time. Did you need that money to get three-quarters of the vote in the district? So what were you doing with all that money?
Well, actually, that money is spent well in advance of an election, keeping people informed about the positions that I've been taking, making sure that we contribute to support a range of community groups who depend on the political process to survive, making sure that we buy tickets and make contributions to the support of schools and sports programs. So it's an ongoing campaign. Our campaign, keeping an office open year-round and staffing it, those are expensive things. So relatively speaking, I probably spend less than most incumbents. And you have to keep in mind that the district that I hold now was held by a Republican for two terms. So I took a district from a Republican who won the district at times at about 65% and took it to where I now get 74%. So I think that we, when you look at the transition from Republican to Democrat and the totals that I get, it's kind of remarkable that I'm able to maintain that spending so little money.
And it's also remarkable, as I looked at a lot of financial statements in preparation for today's program, you probably have the lowest net worth, well, let's say one of the lowest, possibly the lowest net worth of anybody in Congress. You filed financial disclosure information that says you're worth less than $30,000.
Well, I've never made it a quest in life to have more than anyone. It's, to me, it's not about having, it's about being. And I think that the acquisition of material wealth is fine as long as everyone has the chance to do that. And I'm my dedication is towards making sure that I spend my time accumulating ideas, accumulating support for those ideas. And for some people, they spend their time making money. That's okay. I congratulate them on that. That's just not my approach towards life.
You seem to have formed that approach towards life very early on. And one reads in your biography that come from a working-class family, could be certainly called poor, that your family, you and your six siblings and your mother and father moved quite often. You were what we would now call homeless for a while. Pennies had to be counted and saved, very great frugality. And yet at a very early age, you seem to have determined, in fact, right after college, that what you wanted to do was go into politics. You started running for office, announcing that you would run for city council and winning and losing and winning and losing various offices. Can you go back in your mind and kind of recreate for us why someone from a background like yours would want to go into politics at such an early age?
I think, as with many of my generation, I was inspired by John Kennedy. And when I was a freshman in high school, he was inaugurated as president. And I watched that inauguration, and I can still hear his words ringing today when he said, let the word go forth from this time and place that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans. Well,
That was you.
That was me. I was there, along with, I'm sure, thousands of other young Americans who were inspired. And then he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. So I think with many young Americans, I responded to that call for participation. I just didn't, know how you get there, as most people don't know how to get there. So I started my efforts in local politics at age 20. I ran for city council. I was elected in the following election, and that became a career that was part of my passion of life to provide service to people.
You also lost quite a few times, and it's remarkable in many ways that you persisted with it. You spent years in, I suppose, if you ever get around to writing your autobiography, you might call years in the wilderness before coming back to Cleveland, part of the wilderness being California, before coming back to Cleveland and starting getting elected again, starting with a state Senate race. In your mind, why, if you can recreate those years after you lost as mayor of Cleveland and came up against the corporate structure and didn't win, why did you come back to electoral politics again? Did you think it over in your mind and say, the heck with this, let me do something else? Why did you come back to electoral politics again?
Well, first of all, in your characterization of winning and losing, it reminds me of of a quote from Mallory writing about Merlin's counsel to King Arthur after King Arthur had a particularly tough battle. He said that, I'll paraphrase it, that you have to remember that there's defeat in this world for everyone, but we must be able to triumph equally over victory or defeat or and defeat. And so I've had the opportunity to win some and to lose some, but the consistent striving has been towards public service and towards playing a part in trying to make my community a better place and my nation a better place. So that polar star to which I move is public service and a commitment to the world and a belief that the choices that each of us make affect all of us, a belief of a world which is interconnected and interdependent, and the power that each one of us has to affect positive change. So that's what keeps me going.
The conventional wisdom, which is summarized every morning for us in the conventional corporate newspapers, says that although President Bush's poll ratings have been descending rather precipitously lately, he's still not in serious trouble. And let me quote from an article in today's Washington Post, the headline of which is, "War Tab Jeopardizes Party's Domestic Agendas." They're finally getting it that there's a finite amount of money, and you can't keep adopting new states like Afghanistan and Iraq and at the same time provide for everything we need here at home. And the writer of this story says that although polls suggest that most Americans take a dim view of the $87 billion request by President Bush for Iraq and are getting increasingly anxious about rising deficits, it's too early to tell how these concerns might affect the 2004 elections. Do you think it's too early to tell?
No, I think that Americans are more than anxious. I think when they see the poverty rate has grown in this country, when they see there's 41 million Americans without decent health care, when schools are falling apart, unemployment is up, I think it goes beyond anxiety to a condition of concern that this administration represents a certain segment of the economy that's profiting from war, that is profiting from tax cuts, that is profiting from not paying their taxes for reincorporation offshore. And I think the American people are ready for some dramatic change. And that's why what I've been promoting is and is a direction that takes the United States away from war to get out of Iraq and get the UN in to reengage with the world community in the cause of international security and to address our economic issues. You know, this $87 billion that you speak of is on top of an amount of money that's already been spent. There'll be an aggregate of $166 billion over a six-month period.
That's just for starters. We haven't finished
exactly.
With that.
Exactly. And so I think as we see that, American people are saying, well, it's interesting. We had money to blow up bridges over the Tigris and Euphrates, but we didn't have money to build bridges in our own country, have money to blow up electric systems, but not money to build new electric systems. We have money to ruin the health of the Iraqi people, but not money to repair the health of our own. So as people see that, they're saying, well, this administration has not been responsible with its custody of the American dream, and therefore they do not deserve to be reelected. But it's only candidates who can present the sharpest contrast with policies and proposals who will be able to gain the confidence of the American people in the election.
Dennis Kucinich, before we open our phones to our listeners, I'd like to get your take on a phenomenon that's very much on our minds here in California where this program originates, and that's the recall election coming up in about 10 days. You yourself were subject to a recall election, I had forgotten, but in reading over this program, I remember back in Cleveland, and you barely survived a couple of hundred votes in the turbulent times when you were trying to deal with a huge deficit that had been left to you by your Republican predecessor as mayor. A lot of people are looking at this recall election as an extremely reactionary event. Our colleague Norman Solomon has a very thoughtful column in the San Francisco Chronicle Opinion section this morning in which he quotes Chip Berlay and Matthew Lyons talking about repressive populist movements which deflect popular discontent away from positive social change by targeting only small sections of the elite or groups falsely identified with the elite, and especially by channeling most anger against oppressed or marginalized groups that offer more vulnerable targets, such as Latinos who get driver's licenses or a governor as a figurehead of a state. What's your take? You've been in California many times now in the course of your quest for the presidential nomination. What's your take on this recall election?
It's wrong. It is a distraction. It's an attempt to take over the state of Ohio by a very narrow group.
California.
There you go.
We know where you're from.
But it's an attempt to take over California by a very narrow group whose economic interests are not compatible with the people. I mean, when you see, you look at it synergistically. You look at the recall, and you look at Proposition 54. And the same people who are promoting the recall are promoting Proposition 54. There's an attempt to run an agenda here, which is exclusive, which is not in the interest of the people of California. I oppose the recall because I'm aware of how California started to build these huge deficits. The Bush administration's economic policies included letting California slide into a fiscal abyss with the push there by the Enrons of the world. Enron helped to drive a significant deficit in California. And Enron was given that license to do so by the Bush administration and their close ties. So you have the energy policies of the administration adversely affecting California. You have the economic policies of the administration, the tax policies adversely affecting California. And you have a condition which Gray Davis is being asked to pay for. I think that the recall ought to be defeated, and the people of California ought to be preparing to go after the real culprits, and that is the Bush administration in 2004. So I'm urging everyone to vote against the recall, vote against Prop 54, and free California from this grip of this, as you describe it, reactionary, or Norman Solomon has described it, a reactionary group that's simply trying to deflect attention away from the real concerns of the people of the state.
Our toll-free phone number, if you wish to dialogue or ask a question of Dennis Kucinich, who's here with us live this morning, is 1-800-958-9008, 1-800-958-9008, and we'll be right back. Kucinich will shortly be leaving for Los Angeles, where he will be this afternoon, and he has a couple of events, actually three, over the next couple of days that our Southland listeners may be interested in. Today from noon to 1:30, sometime in there, he's going to be at the Yoga Expo at the Los Angeles Convention Center. That's today from noon to 1:30. He'll be getting there, I would imagine, around 12:30. And then from 2 to 3, there's a World Fest Vegan Festival in Woodley Park, Woodley Park in Van Nuys, just off the 405. And he will be there from 2 to 3 this afternoon. And then tomorrow morning in Westwood from 8 to 9:30, he'll be speaking at a breakfast meeting with the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community in the Regency Room in Westwood. That's at Wilshire and I don't know where the intersection is, but it's 10900 Wilshire in Westwood tomorrow morning, 8 to 9:30, the Regency Club Room. Dennis Kucinich will be there. These are rather, I think you would agree, unusual campaign appearances. The Yoga Expo, the Vegan Festival, and the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community, Dennis Kucinich. You won't be stepping on the toes of too many of the other nine Democratic candidates there, I wouldn't think.
My presidency is about reaching out to the diversity of this country. And while my politics in Cleveland and in Ohio have reached out to the more conventional groups of labor and the business community, I've also made it a point to reach out to the diverse communities to make sure people know that they'll have a president of all the people.
Our first caller is Gene in Los Angeles. Good morning, Gene. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. I'm voting for Dennis Kucinich for president, but I have a comment about what, Larry, I believe you were alluding to in your questioning, which is about the propaganda that's involved in election races, in political campaigns. I mean, we see it here in California now with Arnold Schwarzenegger's campaign spending about 10 times more than any other campaign. And this is the question. How can we get the electorate more involved, the voters more involved in elections when they see these propaganda campaigns where you don't really have to be the most qualified candidate? In fact, usually it takes so much money to run in these races that you have to be the kind of candidate who agrees with the rich people and the corporations who fund the election races, or you don't get enough money to run for office. So all the candidates are kind of incompetent and agree with policies that benefit the rich.
Good question, Gene. Dennis Kucinich?
There's an element of truth to what the caller says, and that is that there's a corporate agenda which helps to guide politicians because of this corrupt campaign finance system. I mean, if there's ever a moment where we recognize the need for public financing of our political campaigns, this should be the moment, because we see that policies that have taken us to war in Iraq are inevitably influenced by corporate interests. Policies that would keep us there are influenced by corporate interests. Policies which redistribute the wealth upwards are sped along by corporate interests. The Enrons of the world gain their power with political contributions. So what the caller says is true. On the other hand, I think we have to be aware of the impact of negative politics. We need campaigns which inspire people, which cause people to want to vote. So many of our campaigns end up being slugfests, which discourage people. I mean, there's been studies done on this, that people have actually been discouraged from voting because of negative campaigns. And I think that candidates have to be direct on the issues, but at the same time, they have to come from the heart. They have to come from a spiritual capacity that embraces everyone and lifts conditions up, instead of just saying, well, you know, the world's going to hell in a handbasket and we can't do anything about it.
We should mention also, Dennis Kucinich, that your website includes details about how people can get involved in your campaign. One of the things you do is you have meet meetings where people get together who sign up online, actually not just all over the country, but all over the world, as I was scrolling around in it. And it's on the first Thursday of every month, and there are thousands and thousands of people already doing that. And if you want to find out how to get involved, should you be interested, you can go to www.kucinich.us and just noodle around. You'll find it very easily in the left-hand column. Sarah in Santa Monica, thank you for joining us.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes, Mr. Kucinich, my question is, we know that there is a very high rate of incarceration of African Americans and Latinos. And I would like to know if you will allow that situation to stand as it is, or if you will try and do something about it. Now, that's one reason I'm voting yes on the recall for Davis, because he's strongly, very strongly in favor of this incarceration.
And he takes tons of money from the Prison Guards Union.
Yes.
Well, I can speak for
I'll
myself.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for calling.
I'm not in favor of this national policy, which continues to put more and more people, particularly people of color, into prisons without doing anything to analyze the underlying causes which get people there, or to consider a shift in our philosophy of law enforcement.